Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Today we are continuing our discussion of campaign finance in the United States and the ways that money has been collected and spent and the efforts to regulate it. As I said on the last one, I find a lot of this depressing because it just becomes a corruption party. We left off with the McKinley campaign of 1896, which got a lot of contributions and was the subject of many accusations of corrupt finance practices. So today, we're going to start by segueing into things by talking about the man who became president when McKinley was assassinated 6 months into his second term as president, and that is Theodore Roosevelt.
So when Theodore Roosevelt ran for re-election in 1904, a fundraising scandal arose around his campaign. At this point, collecting donations from supportive voters had become commonplace, but it was discovered that the Roosevelt campaign had a lot of money coming in from corporate donors. Specifically, insurance companies had given very large amounts of money to his campaign, and they had done so in prior Republican campaigns. This came on the heels of articles in the press suggesting that Roosevelt, who claimed to be antitrust, was in fact supported by various corporate trusts. A write-up in the Freeport Bulletin of Freeport, Illinois, on October 2, 1904, outlined the likely donations, and it concluded with, quote, "Of course, the Beef Trust and all other trusts will support Roosevelt, and a truthful answer to the New York World's inquiries with reference to their respective contributions would make interesting campaign literature."
In response, Roosevelt, who won the election, mentioned in multiple addresses to Congress in 1905 that campaign finance had to be reformed. In December of 1905, he stated, quote, "In political campaigns in a country as large and populous as ours, it is inevitable that there should be much expense of an entirely legitimate kind. This, of course, means that many contributions, and some of them of large size, must be made. And as a matter of fact, in any big political contest, such contributions are always made to both sides. It is entirely proper both to give and receive them unless there is an improper motive connected with either gift or reception." Later in that same speech, he continued, quote, "All contributions by corporations to any political committee or for any political purpose should be forbidden by law. Directors should not be permitted to use stockholders' money for such purposes, and, moreover, a prohibition of this kind would be, as far as it went, an effective method of stopping the evils aimed at in Corrupt Practices Acts. In 1906, Senator Benjamin Tillman of South Carolina introduced legislation banning corporate campaign contributions. The Tillman Act was signed into law by Theodore Roosevelt on January 26, 1907.
The next move by Congress that was intended to advance campaign finance reform was the Federal Corrupt Practices Act, also known as the Publicity Act, which passed in 1910. This act instituted a regulation that required candidates for the House of Representatives to account for their campaign finances and disclose their fundraising and donation details. That same act was amended in 1911 to extend the same requirement to senatorial campaigns.
In addition to requiring full disclosure of all monies contributed and collected for campaigns, the Federal Corrupt Practices Act also introduced a cap to the amount that could be spent on a candidate's campaign. For candidates running for seats in the House, that cap was $5,000. For candidates running for Senate, the cap was $10,000. Those numbers could be lower if there was a state law in the state the candidate was running that set a lower cap. If that was the case, the state law, the lower amount, set the limit.
10 years after the caps were put in place for senatorial candidates, Truman Handy Newbery was convicted of violating the Federal Corrupt Practices Act. The accusations against him began when he soundly beat Henry Ford in the 1918 primary for a senator seat in Michigan. He had gone on to win that seat. Ford put the might of his wealth and influence behind pushing for an investigation because he did not believe that Newbery should have beaten him, thanks to Ford obviously having very extensive name recognition. That investigation revealed that Newbery had spent $100,000 on the campaign and had been found to have some irregularities in his election spending.
But Newbery appealed the judgment, and his case ended up before the Supreme Court. Their ruling was that under the Constitution, Congress did not have the power to regulate spending on primaries. The guilty verdict in the earlier case was overturned, and Newbery was determined to be entitled to the Senate seat that he had won in the campaign after he had won the primary, although he was kind of chastised for spending so much. The issue of whether or not Congress could weigh in on how primaries were conducted regarding election finance would come up again a couple of decades later, and we're going to talk about that in just a bit.
In 1925, the Federal Corrupt Practices Act was amended again. At that point, it became a requirement for any campaign contribution greater than $100 to be reported. Additionally, campaigns had to account for all of their contributions and spending.
All of this regulation up to this point seemed like a pretty great idea on paper. Of course, there needed to be laws about donations to curb money coming into campaigns with strings attached that included the expectation of favorable legislation for the donator. But there really wasn't a system in place to enforce any of this. In the case of Ford and Newbery, for example, the investigation really only got going because Henry Ford was a prominent person who really pushed for it. Nobody else had flagged it because there wasn't anybody to cover this stuff. And there were always ways for people to get around regulations and lax enforcement of those regulations, even once they were reported. The $100 reporting limit in the 1925 revision of the FCPA did not include any penalties for campaigns that failed to file their required reports. It's like, you have to do this or else. Shrug, there was nothing that was going to happen to them. Additionally, people could easily donate multiple times in amounts less than $100 or $100 at a time, making up multiple hundreds, if they claimed they were donating on behalf of different committees. They would just say, this is a donation from this committee, and then it would sail right through.
In the early 1940s, political action committees, or PACs, formed as a way to skirt the earlier regulations that made it illegal for corporate entities to donate to campaigns. By forming these associations, companies could leverage their size by asking employees to donate to create a voluntary fund. Folks may have experienced this in their working lives today.
Yep.
This workaround was also adopted by unions and trade organizations. This came on the heels of the Smith-Connelly Anti-Strike Act. That sounds like it wouldn't have anything to do with campaign finance, but it did. The major portion of the act enabled the president to seize plants that were part of war production and manage those plants. The act was catalyzed by a massive number of strikes, about 1,200, that had taken place in the year and a half starting in December of 1941. The concern, of course, was that if a plant producing material vital to the war effort went on strike, it could negatively impact the United States in World War II.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt vetoed the bill. In his comments on the bill, he stated, quote, "I am unalterably opposed to strikes in wartime. I do not hesitate to use the powers of government to prevent them." But he then outlined his various issues with the bill as it stood and noted that he really thought it was going to create more problems than it solved before concluding with, quote, "I recognize that this bill has an entirely praiseworthy purpose to ensure full war production, but I am convinced that Section 8 will produce strikes in vital war plants which otherwise would not occur. Therefore, I could not properly discharge the duties of my office if I were to approve."
But the section related to campaign contributions was in Section 9, and FDR had issues with that as well, writing, quote, "Section 9 of the bill prohibits for the period of the war political contributions by labor organizations. This provision obviously has no relevancy to a bill prohibiting strikes during the war in plants operated by the government or to a War Labor Disputes Act. If there be merit in the prohibition, it should not be confined to wartime, and careful consideration should be given to the appropriateness of extending the prohibition to other nonprofit organizations." Despite the president's veto, the bill passed through a congressional override. In 1947, this wartime legislation became permanent with the passing of the Taft-Hartley Act.
In 1944, the Congress of Industrial Organization, or CIO for short, formed the first political action committee. The CIO, which formed in 1935, was a federation of workers' unions that included groups from both the U.S. and Canada. Since unions couldn't donate to political campaigns, the CIO PAC created an organization through which large numbers of workers who were members of the affiliated unions could pool their money into one large resource to put behind the candidates they felt aligned with their goals and desires.
In a moment, we'll return to that issue of whether or not Congress could get involved in how primaries ran. But first, we will pause for a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Going back to that issue of Congress regulating primaries, in 1944, a legal battle led to the Supreme Court reversing its earlier position that Congress couldn't make laws about how primaries were run. That case was Smith versus Allwright, and the issue at hand was racial discrimination. As far back as 1923, the Texas Democratic Party had limited voting in primary elections to white voters only. You will sometimes see these referred to in textbooks or history books as white primaries. This was made possible because of a state law that enabled political parties to operate their primaries with their own rules as they saw fit. But a black dentist named Lonnie E. Smith pursued the issue legally as a clear instance of racial discrimination in violation of the U.S. Constitution.
According to newspaper reports, Texas had an estimated 571,000 black residents of voting age in the early 1940s. They were being shut out of all the primaries along with anyone else who was not white. The Supreme Court overturned the 1935 decision 8-1. Justice Owen J. Roberts was the sole dissenter. He stated that the decision indicated an intolerance for the decisions of earlier justices involved, quote, as assumption that knowledge and wisdom reside in us, which was denied our predecessors. Sort of how time and human knowledge work.
Right. We should all be, theoretically, more knowledgeable than people who came before us because we have discovered more in the intervening years. That dissent is real weird to read, in my opinion. If you have filed taxes in the U.S., in recent years, I should say, you've been asked to answer a question via a checkoff, which is, quote, do you want $3 of your federal tax to go to the presidential election campaign fund? That idea began with the Presidential Election Campaign Fund Act of 1966, though at the time, the opt-in was for $1, not $3. And that was initiated as a way to curb corrupt donation practices. The opening paragraph of that act reads, quote, in the past, political campaigns for the presidency and vice presidency have been financed generally through voluntary contributions by individuals and corporations. In some instances, devices have been perfected to disguise these voluntary contributions as trade or business expenses in order to obtain a tax deduction for the amounts involved. Each time one of these devices has been detected, Congress has acted to prevent its continuation. And conversely, each time Congress has acted, it has made campaign financing more difficult. Against this background, it has become increasingly clear that new methods of financing campaigns must be found.
The Presidential Election Campaign Fund Act set up a system where the taxes paid each year to the government, taxpayers can opt for a small amount to be placed into this presidential election campaign fund, quote, for the purposes of defraying expenses incurred by political parties in running candidates for president and vice president. Political parties could only get reimbursement payouts from the fund if their candidate, quote, receives at least 5 million votes in the preceding presidential election. But the new law was suspended in 1967 and then reintroduced in the Revenue Act of 1971, which is usually discussed in tandem with the next piece of legislation that we're talking about. This tax return opt-in was put into practice in 1973.
The Federal Election Campaign Act was passed into law in 1971, and it went into effect on April 7th, 1972. And this marks what is often considered the start of the modern era of campaign finance law, because it did a lot. It also kicked off a decade of just constant back and forth about how campaign finances should work. The FECA required that all campaigns report all of their incoming and outgoing finances. It also laid out a lot of regulations for how PACs operated. One big change was that it enabled corporate entities, unions, etc., to put their own money into setting up and running PACs, and then the money that they collected through the PACs, which are also called separate segregated funds, if you ever see that, that means a political action committee's fund, could be donated to campaigns at the federal level. So they could pay for running the whole thing and then use all of the money people donated to give to candidates.
This led to a lot of problems, because there wasn't any kind of regulatory agency or body that could really keep an eye on these rules. Once again, the implementation really couldn't keep up with the regulation. Compliance monitoring fell to the clerk of the House, the secretary of the Senate, and the controller general of the United States General Accounting Office. All of those people had plenty of other duties. More than 7,000 instances of fraud or campaign finance abuse were brought before the Justice Department after the 1972 election. Almost none of them got to litigation.
Because nobody had the time. Watergate was the next big scandal that impacted campaign finance reform. So this is a quick, bare-bones reminder on the complex layers of what happened there. Five men were caught in June of 1972 breaking into the Democratic Party campaign offices in the Watergate complex. That was their second break-in. The first was in May, and during that break-in, they had already stolen documents related to the campaign, which they intended to use to get President Richard Nixon reelected. Nixon claimed to know nothing about the break-in and managed to stay out of the scandal long enough to get reelected. Then, an anonymous informant told Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post that the president and members of his staff absolutely knew about the break-in and that Nixon had paid the burglars to keep his name out of it. He had also tried to obstruct the investigation into the situation. Then, when it was discovered that Nixon taped all of his conversations in the Oval Office, the Supreme Court had to order him to turn those tapes over, and they provided evidence that Nixon had indeed been trying to cover up the break-in and his involvement in it. That is the shortest, least nuanced version of the Watergate scandal we can give you.
So this wasn't exactly an event tied to campaign finances, but it brought the issue of government corruption into really sharp focus and led to calls to tighten up regulatory efforts. Until this point, that had just been handled in a very catch-as-catch-can kind of way, even as various laws had been passed. This is a similar inflection point to the way that the Swartwout case had brought attention to the assessments that were being made against government workers' salaries that we talked about last time.
2 years after the Watergate story broke, the Federal Election Commission, FEC, was formed as part of a massive overhaul of the Federal Election Campaign Act. This amendment is sometimes referred to as a full rewrite, and that is because it did include a lot of changes, including providing for federal funds to go to presidential primary candidates and setting limits on both the spending and contributing sides of the ledger. It required disclosure of contributions, and it limited the amount a candidate could spend of their own money on their campaign. These regulations applied to anyone running for a federal office, and of course, as we said, it set up the FEC.
The FEC was established to round up the work that had been spread among multiple government offices as an extra duty. It made all of that the function of one oversight agency. That work included monitoring campaign funds and their reporting, writing regulations regarding those things, and the authority to oversee enforcement of the regulations. The 1974 amendments to the Federal Election Campaign Act set the nature of the commission's makeup. The Speaker of the House, the President pro tempore of the Senate, would each appoint two voting members, as would the President. The Secretary of the Senate and the Clerk of the House would also be on the commission, but they would not be voting members. That commission started its work officially on April 14, 1975.
But the legislation that established the Federal Election Commission was legally challenged right after it was passed. And we're going to get into that case after we take a break to hear from the sponsors that keep the show going.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1976, the Supreme Court heard the landmark case Buckley versus Valeo, which challenged elements of the 1974 updates to campaign finance law. This case had been filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia by Senator James L. Buckley, a Republican from New York, and it was initially filed in January 1975. Buckley had become the primary leader in the charge that changes to the Federal Election Campaign Act were unconstitutional. Francis R. Valeo, the named defendant representing the federal government, was the secretary of the U.S. Senate and one of those non-voting FEC commissioners. After a lower court shifted the case around and then upheld the constitutionality of the regulations, Buckley appealed to the Supreme Court, and that appeal was filed on September 19, 1975, and the judgment was shared on January 30, 1976.
The main argument in Buckley versus Valeo was that the changes to the act were unconstitutional. Primarily, limitations on the use of money for political purposes were in violation of the First Amendment protections for free expression. Quote, since no significant political expression could be made without the expenditure of money. There were other points within the filing, including the complaint that there should be no limitations on the amounts of expenditures of volunteers made on campaigns. Basically, if somebody wanted to travel on their own expense to help the campaign or do anything else that cost money with no expectation of reimbursement, there should be no limit on it. And that limiting a candidate from spending as much of their own money as they wanted on a campaign was also unconstitutional.
This was a big case, and the court's decision on it was a mixed bag. Contribution ceilings were not in violation of the First Amendment, per the Supreme Court. In a 6-2 vote, the court upheld the limits as set down in the 1974 law, which were a $1,000 limit for individual contributions to a single candidate, a $5,000 limit on PAC contributions to a single candidate, and a $25,000 limit on individual contributions for a given year. So if you're like, wait, you just said $1,000. The idea was that if you were a person very flush with cash, you could donate, for example, $1,000 to 25 different people.
But when it came to spending on the part of a candidate, the court deemed the restrictions unconstitutional as it, quote, reduced the quantity of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of the exploration, and the size of the audience reached. This is because virtually every means of communicating ideas in today's mass society requires the expenditure of money.
So yeah, if you're rich, spend as much as you want. Go ahead. As for the FEC creation and disclosure of contributions requirements, the court upheld those, although the nature of the selection of FEC officials was struck down. And that was because there was a little bit of a mismatch in power and appointment, because Congress appointed four of the commissioners, but they then had executive powers, which just didn't quite work out. The appointment structure was amended in May 1976, with the president appointing the six voting members of the commission and the Senate then confirming them.
With parts of the Federal Election Campaign Act revision struck down by the Supreme Court, there was another round of updates in May of 1976, the same round that changed the FEC appointee process. In addition to that update, the limits on expenditures were repealed. The exception to that limit was that if a candidate accepted public funding, then the limits would still apply.
Yes, yeah, so that kind of refers back to that, do you want money to go into the presidential election campaign fund? If they take from that fund, they would still have the limitations. New revisions to the law that were not prompted by the Buckley versus Valeo decision were also included. These were related to how PACs could fundraise. The ways in which a company or labor organization could solicit donations were much more clearly defined, and who could be solicited as part of those efforts was also limited.
Another set of amendments to the FECA came in 1979. In this case, it was largely about the nature of reporting campaign finances and making that a simpler process. The amount of money candidates could receive through public fundraising grants was also bumped up.
All of these limitations and caps on contributions led to a workaround, which is called a party building expense. These expenses were not campaign specific, so it was possible to take in as much money as anyone wanted to give without limitation, because you could say it was to make the party stronger, not for this campaign. And this so-called soft money was often donated by exactly the groups that had been regulated and limited in prior legislation. So a lot came from labor unions and corporations. So as the tumultuous decade of the 1970s ended, there were more regulations to limit campaign finance than ever, but there was also more money flowing into political party coffers than ever.
In the four decades since about 1980, there of course, have been a lot more changes to campaign finance law and plenty of inappropriate collection and use of funds. And we said we were mostly going to take this through 1980, but we're going to include a list of some of the most impactful events since then.
So in 1986, the FEC filed the case FEC versus Massachusetts Citizens for Life Incorporated. MCFL had published a voter's guide that encouraged voters to cast ballots for pro-life candidates, which the FEC considered campaigning using its general treasury. But because MCFL wasn't a for-profit corporation and did not take any money from for-profit corporations, it was, per the Supreme Court ruling, allowed to advocate. And this set a precedent for nonprofit corporations having the freedom to advocate in campaigns.
But that decision opened the door for the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, claiming that they were also a nonprofit and should be allowed to donate funds for candidate ads. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled against them because a Chamber of Commerce got its treasury money from member dues, and those dues came from business entities.
The 1996 presidential election was rife with the use of those party-building campaign funds as an excuse to take in just huge sums of soft money. The Clinton campaign was embroiled in a scandal when the Justice Department investigated the DNC's fundraising and discovered that the People's Republic of China was attempting to funnel money into the DNC.
In 2002, an effort was made to curb some of the ways political groups were circumventing the law with the passing of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that was sponsored by Senators John McCain of Arizona and Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. This bill had been in play before McCain's failed 2000 presidential run. President George W. Bush signed the bill into law after it barely squeaked through the Senate. It included language intended to end the various soft money measures that had been used to make donations that would have been prohibited by earlier reform law. If you've ever wondered why ads you see online or on television have this line where a candidate says they approve the message, it's because the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act included a clause that required that. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was challenged almost immediately by a group that's somewhat surprising in its mix. It was filed as McConnell versus FEC because Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell spearheaded the effort, but he was supported by the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations and the ACLU and the NRA and the California Democratic Party. That's a spectrum.
Basically, everyone wanted to be able to keep that money moving.
Yeah. So the main arguments were that the ban on soft money and stipulations in this act, which people call BICRA, regarding content, source, and timing of political ads, both infringed on the First Amendment. But the Supreme Court upheld almost all of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. One of the elements that was struck down was a ban on contributions from minors.
And that's minors meaning people under the age of 18, not minors
not
as a profession.
People that work in a mine, unless those are minors under the age of 18.
Since McConnell versus FEC, there have been a variety of legal maneuvers regarding campaign finance. But the most impactful, I think most people would agree, was the 2010 decision in Citizens United versus FEC. Citizens United is a conservative nonprofit group that had funded a film called Hillary, the Movie, which was a partisan documentary that was slated for a video-on-demand release right before the Democratic primaries. The FEC blocked this documentary's advertisements and release as electioneering communication, banned under BICRA as a big money campaign contribution. So Citizens United filed suit based on the case that their First Amendment rights were violated by the regulation. The case went before the Supreme Court with arguments on March 24, 2009. The case was then re-argued in September of that year, and the decision was handed down on January 21, 2010.
So this case is often summed up as the one where corporations were ruled to be people, but of course that's an oversimplification. The element of the majority decision that has gotten shorthanded that way is the determination that political speech is a vital part of democracy, even if that speech is from a corporation. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote in the majority decision that, quote, independent political spending was covered as free speech under the First Amendment. Basically, as long as it's not affiliated with a candidate's campaign, a corporation can spend as much as it wants, saying whatever it wants about politics. This decision is based on the presumption that independent political spending is unlikely to become embroiled in corruption, which, of course, is not the case. The most troubling result of this decision is that it grants incredible political power to the wealthy without any legal need for disclosure about sourcing or spending of money. It's really opened the door to outside groups creating what are referred to as super PACs, so political action committees that don't give directly to candidates and thus are not governed by any FEC regulation.
Yeah, sometimes you'll see some confused takes that the FEC regulations were gotten rid of as part of this. They weren't. They're still in place. Those caps on donations and spending still exist, but they don't apply to super PACs of outside groups. So that's where we're going to end this. And I will say again, if campaign finance law seems like a big depressing morass of already powerful people exploiting and skirting the system to get what they want, listen, you're not wrong. And it's constantly in a state of legislation. People with power will do what they can to retain that power. And the same goes for wealth. And this entire subject is, as I said, constantly being discussed, debated, re-legislated, and challenged, and it will be as long as the U.S. exists. So as painful as some of this is, at least for me, to talk about, and it can be very confusing and it's hard to sort through all this stuff, it's really vitally important that you understand how elections actually work. If you live in the United States, if you live outside of the United States, same thing for your country, but also helps to understand how other countries work. I'm sorry, this is depressing. I promise the next one will be fun because I don't think I can take another one of these. I have fun email.
Oh, good.
As an apology from our listener, Matt, who, bless him, wrote up his email as a document because it's a little longish. So I'm going to edit a little as we go. There are so many cat pictures and they are exactly the flavor I love. And I will tell you why when we get there. He writes, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. I tend to be wordy, so I'm going to try to keep this brief for you best I can. I had a moment yesterday in my kitchen where I found myself doing what can only be described as a hold my breath, exasperated groan of delight, which I know isn't a combination I knew was possible either. Now, I cannot recall which recent episode it was where the two of you discussed the merits or not of puns and whether you think puns are funny. This anecdote is why I felt so compelled to share. During Behind the Scenes on July 14th, Tracy was saying her mom, in an effort to make a ramen-adjacent dish, made what she described as a faux fondue, and Holly interjected with a quick, would that be fondue, with a quick apology, said, I belong in jail for the terrible pun. I actually think I'm the one that hates puns more.
I think...
I hate them.
I think you probably hate them more. I think probably, like, a really well-crafted, delightful one, I'm like, that's fun, but a lot of the ones I hear are sort of the most obvious
clunkers.
Corny joke.
Yes. But Matt goes on. Here's where the hold my breath, exasperated groan of delight part of it all comes in. I am an occupational therapist and I work in cognitive rehabilitation and mental health. While working with teens struggling with depression and suicidality, one of my best stories came out of my famous humor group. We would talk about the mental and physical health benefits, be it chemical, social, relational, of humor, comedy, laughter in general, and yes, puns. Essentially, kids had to find a joke from my joke books or come up with one of their own and draw them out on comic book strips and then present their joke and animated representation to the rest of the group. A really beneficial task in a lot of ways, and the best part, all the while, I got to spend every spare moment telling groany dad joke level puns. The shining moment came one day while running this group for the umpteenth time, and a teenage gal who had been hiding in her sweatshirt with full rain cloud energy, who had not said a word or looked up the entire time, finally ripped off her hood and glared at me and said, you know what? You belong in the punitentiary. And practically dove back into her hoodie, but this time with just a hint of a satisfied smirk. The entire room burst out laughing. Nothing better, dishing up a sick burn for a group leader. As the kids say, she understood the assignment. Certainly one of those why we do this work kind of moments. So back to the theatrics of me in my kitchen at 7 a.m. exclaiming out loud, but punitentiary was right there! After Holly said, I belong in jail for that one. Also, I feel like the work you're doing is really important, so thank you, Matt. The cat tax is incredible. Pete and Elliot are gray kitties, which I have two brothers who are gray kitties, one of whom is like a gray morning coat style, and we have one solid gray. Theirs both have morning coats. These cats are so stinking cute. They're like little feline arrows to my heart. They are so adorable. And then there is also a... a suggestion for a possible future episode, and Matt is going to be my penitentiary cellmate. That sounds fine. We'll talk about gray kitties. It'll be good. Thank you for this because it did make me chuckle. And here's what I really want to thank you for. It made me think of puns in a more positive way because if they can be used for occupational therapy, like that's a validation of their existence that I had not thought of or heard about before, and now I will be gentler when I encounter puns because I know that sometimes they're just good for mental health and not to dog on anybody else's delight in that regard. If you would like to write to us, you can do so at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can do that on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.